Welcome to the Western Mass Room Center tonight for a very, very special ending of our season with an international fellowship. And I have a few things to say first, and then Thayer Green, our local elder analyst, will introduce them. Okay, so there will be no break. So if you need to go to the bathroom, go. And if you really need to go ring, that's fine. Donations are very useful for us. It's a small organization, as everybody knows, so we appreciate that. Afterwards, we're going to have a very simple reception so that we can just talk and socialize a little bit and talk about the lecture or whatever we want to talk about. And thank you for Carol LeVay. Where are you, Carol?
She's running around out there.
Anyway, so Carol put the two together, and I want to also thank Dan Brunwald, our website master magician, who puts all this together on the web and helps this society grow. Amazing. Thank you. Okay, I have a few announcements. If you like what you hear tonight, Don Kelship will be lecturing, and he'll talk a little bit about them, if that'll care, at the Boston Institute in Newbury, Massachusetts, on Friday, and he'll give an all-day workshop on Saturday, which I highly recommend. And there's a copy of this over there. I have a couple of copies, so just look at it. The workshop on Saturday is from 10 to 3 a.m. Don Kelship has written two books. One is The Inner World of Trauma. If you haven't read it, it's wonderful. When did you publish it?
96.
And this is just out on his website, which he will be talking about, I'm sure. Trauma and the Soul, which is also on coming out on Amazon May 28th. Okay, that's okay. And then another thing that is going on is there's a pamphlet over there from the Boston Institute, and there's a summer intensive program from June 20th to the 22nd, and it's on psychology, religion, and spirituality. Current research and multicultural experience. And Thayer and Anita Green and I will be teaching with four other analysts from Boston. So the brochures are over there. You can go to their website and get that information if you're interested. Another very exciting thing that's happening is the Boston Jung Institute, which trains analysts, has just started an auditor program. So if you're interested in Jung, professionally, personally, or clinically, you can attend the seminars that the candidates take and without having to become an analyst. And then if you want to become an analyst, that credits you towards becoming an analyst. But so you can take the seminars at the first phase of the program. So it's very exciting. We're very excited about it. This is over there, too, if you're interested in it. And the August 1st is the deadline to apply for it. Okay. Just a couple more things. We have a few people. I want to congratulate our board for such a good year. We've had an amazing year. And but we have a few people who are leaving the board, which is always very sad. Bob Wiener is leaving the board, but he will be a part of a program called Arts is Transformation next year. He's a musician. And along with the head of the arts therapy department at Springfield College. So you'll see that coming up in maybe September or sometime next year. Also, Nomi Kluger-Nash is leaving, our editor, our superb editor, proofreader, and we will miss her. And then Don Bukesh, I want to thank very much. He's going back to Texas. And when did you start?
Well, 2004.
He's been on the board since 2004.
Oh, yeah. Not on the board, yeah. I was 2000. Seven.
He doesn't. But he is the one who launched us on the web with utter determination and very little knowledge, and he did an amazing job. So let's get on. So, hope you stay afterwards a little bit and share and talk. And now I'm going to turn this over to Derek Green.
It is my pleasure and privilege to introduce someone who has been a long-term friend, colleague, student, and then teacher and mentor to me after first I was something of a mentor to him. Don Paulshett and his lovely wife, Robin. There's already been a spiel about the books, so I don't need to go into that. What I would say is that when his book, Inner Trauma, The Archetypal Defenses of the Human Spirit, was published in 1996, it really, for many of us in the field of analytic therapy, opened a locked door. It's the best way I can describe it. He was able to get inside of a phenomenon that all of us ran up against, which is the situation of some of our clients who clearly had a capacity for growth and who would have dreams that suggested the potential of growth, and then at a certain point, something would shut down and the door would be locked. And you had this feeling that it was a little like Sisyphus. You could get a certain distance in the work, and then you were up against something that you didn't really understand fully. And Don, in his first book, opened that locked door and helped us to really begin to appreciate a level of self-defense, and I mean that the defense by the self, that was rooted in early global kind of trauma, and that we had not in some way fully understood or underestimated in the way we approached our therapeutic process. So that was a really important book, not just for Jungians, but broadly across the therapeutic profession. It got a great deal of interest. And on the basis of that, Don emerged as an international lecturer and teacher, and he has really contributed a great deal. As I mentioned, I had some small part in his training long ago, and it was something of a mentor to him, and I was on his graduation thesis committee. You have to write a thesis to graduate from the New York Institute. And I can still remember reading his thesis in my study and then walking upstairs and telling Anita, this man is going to make a major contribution in the field of Jungian psychoanalytic psychotherapy. And I do call myself something of a minor prophet for having seen that. And without further ado, because he has much wisdom to share, I give you Don Paulshett.
Thank you. there. Let me just say a little bit about this book that has finally come out. This is a long, slow curve of fast break. It's been with Routledge for a year, but now publishing, in case those of you may not know, is mostly a business, bottom line kind of business, and they outsource everything because it's cheaper. I don't know where they send it, but mostly it's outsourced to people in the UK. So it's been quite an experience getting this through the pipeline. Finally it's come out, and it looks good. It's not yet published in this country. It will be on May 23rd, and it will be available through Amazon there. So you have to join me in having patience. It's a huge process. I want to start tonight with a quote from Abraham Heschel. What time are we starting? 7:45. Okay. I have about an hour of material, maybe a little more. Do we have? Is that enough time? So 9:30 we can go to. Okay. Good. The search for reason ends at the shore of the known. On the immense expanse beyond it, only the sense of the ineffable can lie. We do not leave the shore of the known in search of adventure or suspense, for because of the failure of reason to answer our questions, we sail because our mind is like a fantastic seashell, and when applying our ear to its lips, we hear a perpetual murmur from the waves beyond the shore. Citizens of two realms, we all must sustain a dual allegiance. I'd like to start with this quote because I want to frame my discussion of trauma and soul this evening between two worlds, between two realms. And Heschel suggests that we have to take seriously the fact that we are citizens of both these realms. On the one hand, of course, we have the familiar material world that we live in most of the time. This world is bound by the usual categories of space and time and provides us scientific answers based on cause and effect reasoning. This is the world of the left hemisphere of the brain, of classic physics, of linear thinking, clear laws about how the universe works. We could not live without this world. Then, according to Heschel, beyond the shore of the known, there is an immense expanse in which only the sense of the ineffable can lie. We might call this second space the spiritual world, in which otherwise invisible realities of the inner landscape meet us with potentially numinous impact. As we sail beyond the shores of the known, we enter what some shamanic practitioners call non-ordinary reality, where the usual laws of the material world don't seem to apply. We experience precognitive dreams that seem to turn our notions of linear time on their head. Synchronous events occur that seem to defy our usual understanding of space. We enter a mysterious quantum world where things emerge and disappear without apparent explanation, and we are mystified. Strange visionary experiences may break into our normal world from this spiritual world, powers that seem to be transpersonal or trans-egoic powers. Angels and demons visit us in our dreams, and we are left to wonder what on earth they mean for our lives. Now, Heschel says that this is part of our human condition, maybe part of our human predicament. We're citizens of two realms, and we must sustain a dual allegiance. This idea has not been popular in psychoanalysis, but Jung insisted on it. He spent his whole life ricocheting around between these two worlds, trying desperately to get them together, the worlds of his number one and number two personalities, the world of the spirit of the times versus the spirit of the depths. That's a prominent tension in the Red Book. God's world versus the secular material world. And in order to accomplish this, he even had to add a whole deeper layer to his model of the unconscious. A layer, he said, from which spiritual powers, that is to say, powers he called archetypal powers, experienced as spiritual powers, impacted the developing ego. So in this way, Jung became perhaps the first psychoanalyst to take seriously the two worlds and one of the first psychoanalytic mystics. He sustained his dual allegiance throughout, although he assiduously avoided making any claims for the ontological reality of two worlds, of the second world. If you remember, Jung said that the events that really interested him, actually more than interested him, really captured his imagination, ignited his wonderment and his curiosity, were where, quote, the imperishable world erupted into this transient one. That's language from Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Tonight I'm going to give you some examples of such eruptions in the ordinary psychotherapeutic work with trauma survivors and try to interest you in the idea that the human soul is uniquely a creature of these moments when the two worlds are potentiated or when our familiar world is penetrated by the ineffable. I'll be saying more than that, but it'll become clearer as we go, that essentially any of you who are practicing psychoanalysis know about Winnicott's transitional space, where there's an interpenetrating mix-up between the actuality of the mother and the baby's imagination. And Winnicott's paradigmatic moment there is, he says, the baby in its hunger hallucinates the breast, and the mother in her empathy puts the breast exactly at the point of the hallucination. And there's a moment where the baby simultaneously discovers the world and finds it. So, and you never ask a baby, says Winnicott, did you find this out there or did you make it up? Because to do that is to collapse the space. Trauma collapses transitional space. Transitional space opens in psychotherapy. It opens in many situations. It opens in a love relationship. It opens in moments in nature. It opens all over the place. But the idea I'm trying to interest you in tonight is that transitional space closes, and with it, a process in which the world stays open for discovery and creativity. James Grafstein has said, trauma is about encountering the world before you have a chance to discover it. It's a wonderful phrase. Now, the other thing I want to interest you in is that, and this Winnicott didn't really talk about very much, I'm not sure he got it, in the same way that Jung got it. When these two worlds are reopened, the mythopoetic psyche comes back into manifestation. And we're going to talk about the mythopoetic psyche because that's a word that Jung was very fond of. He traces it to Frederick Myers. Ellenberger, in his monumental book on the history of the unconscious, talks about the mythopoetic psyche. But the main idea here is that when transitional space is opened again, we start to get imagery and dreams and visions and intuitions that inform us about the link between the imagination and reality. Let me give you a quick example. This is a woman who had all but shut down in her life. She was depressed. Her children were now leaving or had already left the house. She had one girl left at home. And she came in because she was depressed. She had been poetic, and she'd been a poet in part of her earlier life. She wanted to find her creativity again. She didn't know what had happened to her. As the therapy opened and she reattached to somebody in the transference, there was a very warm and enabling space that developed between us in the transference. She had the following opening dream. She's in the pet store across the street in Katona, a little village where I used to practice, and she loves animals, and she's walking up and down the aisles of the pet store, and there are the puppies and the kittens and playing in the little newspapers, and she's entranced, and she's just having the greatest time. Suddenly, in one of the cages, she sees to her horror, there's a baby in the cage. Human baby. Its eyes are glazed over. It's in a kind of trance, or it's sort of numb. And she sees in the back of the store owner. And he looks a little bit like Jack Nicholson in The Shining. He's not saying anything, he's standing in the back. He's looking very ominous. And she's terrified, and she goes up to the clerk and says, "What is happening here? How could you have this baby?" And she wants to confront the store owner, but she's afraid. She waits in terror. Well, that's the first little glimpse of the mythopoetic psyche. The way I would understand it now is that a part of her, which I would call the carrier for her soul life, the child in her, had gone back into a trance state, was in a cage, was captive of another part of the psyche, which is the dark supervisor, protector, persecutor, and that she didn't know that this was part of what was going on inside her until the attachment, the reattachment, that had been part of the early traumatic wounding with her mother happened in the therapy. So that's basically the territory I want to describe tonight. Now, those of you who are psychoanalysts will be interested to know, and maybe I'm telling this defensively because many people are now re-interested in mysticism and psychoanalysis. One is the earliest pioneer, who was Sandor Ferenczi, in addition to Jung. He wrote of uncanny human connections in transference and countertransference. Bion spoke of the ineffable reality of O, or the Godhead, as the ultimate source of transformation in psychotherapy. Neville Symington in Australia speaks openly about a mysterious life giver in human experiences that participates in an infinite dimension of being and must be chosen if we are to actualize our own aliveness. Christopher Bolas acknowledges, quote, a mysterious intelligence that moves through the mind and says that if there is a God, this is where it lives. James Grotstein recently wrote about the ineffable subject of the unconscious, who, he says, he personifies it, sends dreams for the benefit of the phenomenal subject, that is the ego, or the small s self. And finally, Michael Eyvind, an avowed psychoanalytic mystic, makes an impassioned appeal that psychoanalytic work should be acknowledged as a religious or holy vocation. Now, these are some of our most esteemed secular scientific analysts. And this is their language. Now, in my experience, psychoanalytic work with the victims of early trauma supports these mystical musings in specific and dramatic ways. Oh, I have another slide here. Here is the pilgrim, spiritual pilgrim, discovering a second world. This is from the Rosicrucian Illumination, where the pilgrim is broken through one world into the other. And both of these are these worlds, as above, so below. As I was saying, psychoanalytic work with the victims of early trauma really supports these mystical musings in dramatic ways. Of these highly sensitive people, and many of the people I work with who are trauma survivors, are what Elaine Aaron in San Francisco would describe as highly sensitive persons. She's done some very interesting work with psychological testing and evaluation and discovered that 20-30% of us are highly sensitive people. And the highly sensitive person seems not often to feel like they belong in a fast-paced, hard-edged, well-armored culture. And if you want to read more, it's Elaine Aaron, HSP, Highly Sensitive People. But many of these highly sensitive people whose cases appear in my book have had mystical experiences. Often they have a soul connection to nature, to animals, to the mythopoetic realm of film, theater, art, literature, and especially poetry. Sometimes they report having been saved by an inner world full of preternatural presences, a world which provided an archetypal container for an innocent and soulful part of them, residing in another world. Often they report synchronous experiences that defy rational understanding, and many of them describe a blurring of boundaries between this world and what they call non-ordinary reality. On the other hand, many of these highly sensitive people are not so pleased with their privileged access to the spirit world, because the vulnerable part of them that has retreated into the unconscious starts to be abused in the inner environment. Attacked by self-hating, demonic persecutors, and this is also a spiritual problem, but a spirituality of darkness and dread and terror. So first, I'd like to give you some comments about trauma and the self-care system, just to orient some of you who don't know my previous work. Trauma results from the fact that we are often given more experience in this life than we can bear to experience consciously. That's about a general understanding or definition you will hear. We are often given more to experience in this life than we can bear to experience consciously. This problem has been around since the beginning of time, but it's especially acute in early childhood, where because of the immaturity of the psyche and or the brain, we're ill-equipped to metabolize our experience. An infant or young child who is abused, violated, or seriously neglected by a caretaking adult is overwhelmed by intolerable affects that are impossible for it to metabolize, much less understand or think about. A shock to the psychosomatic unity of the personality threatens to shatter the child to its very core, threatens to extinguish that vital spark of the person so crucial for the experience of aliveness and so central to the later experience of feeling real. Such a shattering of a childhood psyche would be an unimaginable catastrophe, soul murder, as one investigator called it. Fortunately, this shattering almost never happens. At least not completely. Instead, there's a life-saving split that occurs. We call this defense, and the worst, or the most dramatic defense, and the one that Jung talked about all the time, was dissociation, the literal split between parts of the psyche. Dissociation seals over non-being. It prevents annihilation of the unit self, substituting multiplicity and an archetypal story that implicitly holds the parts together. You're going to see that operate. The unbearable affect is distributed to different parts of the psyche and the soma. These parts stop knowing anything about each other so that the personality doesn't have to suffer the unspeakable horror of trauma as a whole. We could say that the psyche shatters itself along inborn fault lines. That's the line, language of Michael Balin, and that discontinuities or gaps open up in our experience. Now, this is the whole area of defense that I'm talking about, and it's not something that Jung talked much about. He, if you read Jung, even if you go to the collected index of the collected works, you'll find about 3 references to defense. It's implicit, his understanding of defense is implicit in his discussion of conflicts. But he doesn't really talk about defenses as such. And so we're going to be talking about, when I talk about the self-care system and dissociation and early trauma, I'm really talking about the defensive system. The self-divisions that are engineered by the defensive system have survival value because they save a part of the child's innocence and aliveness by splitting it off from the rest of the personality, preserving it in the unconscious. And they preserve it in what various people have called an inner sanctum. John Steiner talks about psychic retreats. Other people talk about the schizoid problem. But the point is that this part of the innocent self-representation of the child is vouchsafed in the unconscious under a kind of guardianship of other parts of the psyche that are appointed to caretaker. You'll have to take my word for it. I'm going to skip all the people that have described this split in psychoanalysis. Imprisoning sanctuary, that Eigen's term for it, psychic cocoon, that's Modell's word for it, psychic retreat, that's Steiner, and so on. Now, in my work as an analyst, I began to find the same pattern in the dream material that was described by these object relations people, with one small difference. Oftentimes, the regressed part of the personality that was back in that sanctuary would appear not just as a child, but somehow, sometimes, as an extraordinary child. One that appeared to be supremely wise or divine in some way, perhaps surrounded by an unearthly light, or speaking in parables, or showing miraculous physical powers. Sandra Ferenczi made the same discovery. He called these wise baby dreams. Sometimes the regressed self will be a magical animal, a talking bird, dolphin, pony, representing a kind of soul animal for the patient. On the other hand, the progressed self, the guardian, may also become mythologized, appearing as a frightening vampire, a sadistic demon, torturing the patient from within. Now, the mythical powers of the self-care system are well represented in this illustration, showing Blake's good and evil angel struggling over a terrified child. This is on the cover of my book. The evil angel is shackled to his flaming darkness, and his unseeing eyes represent the kind of deadening trance of traumatic dissociation. Those of you who are coming to Boston tomorrow, or tomorrow evening, and workshop, will see this angel featured, because I'm going to use Dante's Divine Comedy and the Descent into the Inferno to describe the trauma system and to show the defensive structure of that system. And guess what his name is down in the ninth circle? D-I-S. Dis. Which is fascinating to me. I mean, from which we get dissociation, disease, disconnection, even disaster, which means to come separated from your stars. Disaster. And trauma is just such a disaster. But here we see him not in his accustomed lair with all of his protective demons, which we'll look at tomorrow and Saturday, but he's having a contest with the positive side of the protective system. Now, as I said, I referred to this system as a self-care system, and it's as though in the self-care system, and it's, by the way, I should make an important caveat here. This system isn't a part of all psyches. When we find it in certain people who have had a lot of early and severe injuries and traumatic experiences which they really have to defend against. And it's not they that defend. The defensive system comes into being to rescue them from the experience that they can't metabolize. And this system keeps them constantly vigilant, constantly in a contest with inner voices, constantly projecting the good angel onto idealized therapists, constantly projecting the bad angel onto de-idealized therapists, going back and forth, struggling desperately to humanize this structure which really has them in hell, really. So that's the basic idea of the self-care system. Now, here's a few other images. Guess who that is? That's Dis before he fell. And there's a fascinating story about why he is a fallen angel, why he's called Lucifer, and the story goes basically like this. Lucifer, God's greatest lover, greatest angel, the light bearer, looked into the divine mind and saw there that God was planning a heinous, terrible thing that he just could not countenance. You know what that horrific future crime was going to be? He planned to incarnate in the body of a man and to come down into this world, out of that world, and incarnate. And of course that's recorded in our Christian story, in the history of the man Jesus. But he led a rebellion of angels who fell into oblivion, and here he is. This is Dore, this is Lucifer falling. And here he is in the nether regions, extremely unhappy, but very full of pride. And the reason that so fascinates me as a theological background to this defense is that it means that the defensive personifications get their power from a refusal to embody. Now, we happen to feel our affects in our bodies. So it's a refusal of feeling. It's a refusal to go down into the body and experience all the things that flesh is heir to. So it's a, isn't that a wonderful proof of how this defense comes into being? It just seems to me to be remarkable to, when you just come across something like this. And so...
Wait, what's the proof again? In his story?
No, I don't mean it's literally proof, but I mean what I find so fascinating is that when you look into the etiology of that dark figure in the unconscious that is now called Dis, he was originally a very proud and magnificent angel who lived in the celestial mental world of the cerebral heavenly spheres and refused to come down into to human form. Okay. Okay, now a word about the soul. Mineralogists tell us, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself here. That's what Dis looks like down there. See some more imagery of him tomorrow. There he is. Now the soul. A word about the soul. Mineralogists tell us that if you want to understand the basic structure of a crystal, you should examine the places where it's broken. In a moment, I'll present some cases where traumatic experiences have broken the crystal of people's otherwise cohesive lives and let in a mysterious light. The words of Leonard Cohen come to mind. Ring the bell, it still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's where the light comes in. Naomi Remen used the same image. I don't know whether you ever read this particular paper of hers, but she was working with a man who had come to see her because he was in a terrible accident. He was now paraplegic. And his whole athletic career had been destroyed. And he complained for the first hours of analysis. And she gave him a piece of paper and she said, draw this. And so he took it and he drew a vase. And then he took a big glass brand and made a jagged lightning bolt down this vase. He says, that's me, that's my life. I'm broken forever. Well, that was the beginning of therapy, and Naomi Remen succeeded in helping him to get, to become active in actually take leadership in helping other injured and handicapped veterans to find a way back into athletic competition, back into life. And 2 years later, he brought the same drawing back into her. And this time, he had taken a great yellow crayon. And where the black line was, he had outlined it in yellow. And he said, that's what I realized now. The light has come through my brokenness. Of course, that is a wonderful redemptive story, and exactly what Leonard Cohen was talking about. The cracks in the ego that open up after traumatic shock are created by dissociation. Dissociation is a defense against unbearable experience, and it's something that the psyche just does. It's not we who defend, it's these mechanisms that defend. Oftentimes, when a patient comes in and they're identified with their defense, one of the major things in therapy is to help them disidentify from the defensive process, because everything is all mixed up. They talk about their own convictions through the lens of the defense, through the voice. voice of the defense. And they talk about their feelings as thoughts. And so there's a lot of early help that needs to be given in trying to parse the whole defensive system so that they begin to know the difference between a feeling and a thought and become between a defense and a self-activating moment. Okay, now the soul. In my earlier book, I call this same thing I want to talk about as the soul, the imperishable personal spirit. And in this book, I'm talking about the same thing. I'm just as fascinated and mystified by it as I was then. This vital spark that Winnicott called the true self. He called it a sacred incommunicado center of personality. He says he can't define it, except that it collects around it all the experiences of aliveness. Fairbairn referred to a similar inner object called a libidinal ego. Guntrip, in a poetic metaphor, as the lost heart of the self. T.H. Almas, the diamond heart method, refers to his presence in the personality as essence. Neville Symington, as I mentioned, talks about it as the life giver. And James Gottstein refers to a hostage self that frequently appears in abused, traumatized patients as an undead child, haunting them from within. He also talks about his encounter in patients with a core of innocence. And he says innocence is the crucial element in a person's spiritual nature. Now, in my book, I have a whole chapter on innocence, which I discuss in reference to Saint Exupéry's The Little Prince, and it's a fun chapter to write. Innocence is also not something that we talk about much in psychoanalysis. We have not a doctrine in psychoanalysis of original blessing, as Michael Fox or Matthew Fox would say. We have a dogma of original sin. Comes down honestly through the Christian heritage. But if you read Melanie Klein, you know that the good stuff only comes later. At least I think that's a fair summary for death instinct. Finally, Jung discovered how important it was to support his patient's therapeutic regressions back to early childhood in order to make contact with the core of the self that was hidden in the unconscious. This lost heart of the self, usually an image of a child that Jung discovered, often had an aura of luminosity about it. And here's his quote. As against this idea that regression is pathological, therapy must support the regression and continue to do so until the prenatal stage is reached. It must be remembered that the mother, quote-unquote, is really an imago, a psychic image, not just the personal mother. Hence, the regression leads back only apparently to the personal mother, but goes back beyond her to the prenatal realm of the eternal feminine, to the immemorial world of archetypal possibilities where, thronged round with images of all creation, slumbers the divine child, patiently awaiting his conscious realization. This son is the germ of wholeness, and he is characterized as such by his specific symbols. This child is the germ of wholeness. That's what he means by the divine child. So Jung is saying, we're going to find children in the psyche, but sometimes that child is carrying some sacred baggage. It's not just to be interpreted as the actual personal infant or all the things that accrue to infancy, which such as polymorphous perversity, that was Freud's infantile grandiosity. All of that's true, but there's something else that's carried by that image of the child. This discovery was perhaps the main epiphany in Jung's personal and professional life, the central conviction of his entire authorship, namely that there's a sacred dimension to human life which is also discernible in the psyche's symbolic process, if we learn how to listen and attend to it in our dreams and how to understand. And this sacred dimension often comes to presence during the suffering of the individuation process in the image of the child, a part divine, part human, innocent child whose life is the preoccupation of mythology the world over. The human divine child, in other words, does not belong entirely to this world, and neither do we. This mysterious child in the psyche is what I mean as the soul or the soul carrier. We can think of it as the vital animating core of our embodied selves, a certain essential something that links us through love to the divine, to each other, and to the exquisite beauties of the natural and cultural world. We know the soul when we experience it. But while the soul remains a subjective experience renewed every day in our relationships with people and things and with the ineffable, it remains a complete mystery no matter what we may say about it. As the core of our subjectivity, it is impossible to define objectively. Preferring to live between the worlds, the soul, like quicksilver, slips away as soon as we try to grasp it. It's like light. It's particle, then it's wave. It's particle, then it's wave. And it draws us into ourselves and out into the world, always elusive, material, evanescent, and invisible. Now, here are some slides that show the child between worlds. There's another world, and it's in this one. I'm going to run through these quickly because I don't want to take too much time. Notice where the light's coming from in this child. That's not a painting that would pass muster at the art students' league because the shadows don't come in the right direction. The light is coming from the child. Now here is the two worlds in the famous Annunciation story that we all know so well from our Christian tradition at least. The child is being announced as the child of two worlds. He's going to carry his dual destiny all the way through to his death on the cross. And this is Mary having a dream of the Christ child about to be born. This is the same theme in the Buddhist Maya. She dreamed of the Buddha in her coming down into her in the form of a little white elephant. Here's another carving of Maya receiving the information about this divine and human child. Always dual. And then these next few slides are about the miraculous birth. It's as if mythology needs to find miraculous things about this child to acknowledge its dual origin and its destiny. So it's born from the side. Here's Adonis being delivered from a tree. Here's Dionysus being delivered from the thigh of Zeus by Hermes. Here's Mithra being born from a rock, and it's not just any rock. This is a meteor, a fallen star that comes down and then gives birth to this god. Here's the divine child dancing on a lotus. This is from a birthing temple. 22nd dynasty of Egypt. And you know who this guy is? That's Superboy, born on Krypton. Now this is a modern myth of this same figure. He descends into the earth. He lives his dual destiny with these common, wonderful farm parents. Do you remember the story? And he's told by that father, don't you ever apply your divine powers to the world we're about to send you, because if you do that, you're going to lose them. And in the story, of course, he does that because he falls in love. So if you haven't seen that story, you're missing a great modern myth. Now, just a brief statement about this child. Well, let's see. Wait a minute. Yeah, I'll just leave that up there for a while. Because another dimension of the soul that lends itself to our understanding here is that the soul is understood to develop through a process of what Kovac calls phase-appropriate suffering. Innocence has to accrue experience. The soul has to evolve. And there's this wonderful letter from John Keats to his brother George. Call the world, if you please, a veil of soul-making. Do you know this letter? James Hillman has used it many times. Then you will find the use of the world. I say soul-making as distinguished from intelligence. There may be intelligence or sparks of divinity in the millions, but they are not souls till they acquire identities, till each one is personally itself. Intelligences are atoms of perception. They know and they see and they are pure. In short, they are God. But then how are souls made? How then are these sparks, which are of God, to have identity given to them? How but by a medium of a world such as ours? Don't you see how necessary a world of pain and struggles is to school an intelligence and make it a soul? A place where the heart must feel and suffer in a thousand diverse ways? And so on. So the basic idea is that the soul doesn't just spring full-born into reality. It has to go through a terrible process of suffering and death, in death, in order for it to be fully realized. In Keats's view, the innocent soul, a divine substance or spark, is shaped by suffering as it confronts the pains and troubles of this world. So the idea is we start off a human divine unity of oneness, but the process of our separate human development means a descent or an emptying out of this divinity into human particularity and limitation. It represents a fall away from this primordial sense of oneness in the garden. We forget our origins. And I'm about to tell you a story, which is a very moving story to me, about this process of forgetting. This is in Marcus Borg, called The Heart of Christianity. A little girl, age 3, the firstborn and only child of her family, but now the mother is pregnant again, and the little girl is very interested in this pregnancy and very excited about the new brother about to be born. Shortly after the parents bring the new baby home from the hospital, the little girl approaches the parents and says, "Mommy and Daddy, I want some time alone with the new baby." Well, and sweetheart, what would you like to do? I want to talk to him. You want to talk to him, yes. So the parents are perplexed by this. And so they were very cautious. However, there didn't seem to be any signs of infantile jealousy or, you know, second child's jealousy. And besides that, they realized they had an intercom system set up in the baby's room so they could let her alone with the new brother for a few minutes and they could listen in on the intercom. So the girl kept pestering the parents about this, so they finally let her into the room and so they closed the door and they went, put their ear to the intercom and they hear the little feet padding across to the crib. And the little girl approaches. And she says to her baby brother, "Tell me about God. I've almost forgotten." So the soul's memory of its transpersonal origins are celebrated in many religions. Some of you may have heard of the Hymn of the Pearl, where the man falls asleep. He enters Egypt, he comes down into this world and falls asleep. He has to be awakened by a letter from his father. It's a beautiful story if you ever get it. It's Iranian. And I would look it up on Google, the Hymn of the Pearl. It's a mythopoetic story about this process of falling out of connection to the divine and finding our way back to it. Okay, now some clinical work, some glimpses of the soul and its caretakers. Oh, before I get to that, this is in mythology, when this divine child is born, and we know this from all our traditions, it's a terrible threat to the powers of the realm. So We know that from the Christian story of King Herod, who sends the wise men to find the Christ child because he wants to kill the child, and the slaughter of the innocents comes after that. We find it also in the Greek story of Zeus's birth. Here's baby Zeus being surrounded by the Corybantes. These are the shielding dancers who dance and make such a loud din that they throw off Cronus, who wants to kill and eat and devour Zeus. And so Rhea, his mother, hides the child away. So if you see that the birth of this dual destiny child is a terrible threat to a one-dimensional power card. And so we find, you know, in world mythology, here the Corybantes are again. There's Cronus. Here's the Christian story. The slaughter of the innocents, the escape into Egypt. Okay, now, actually, I want to get back. We'll come to that in a moment. Here's a glimpse of the soul-caring child and its caretakers. This story is from the analysis of a man I call Mike in my book. I devote a whole chapter of our work together. He had a major trauma history, all emotional deprivation, or in other words, small T trauma, not big T trauma, but cumulative and devastating. At the time of this dream, Mike was just beginning to trust our container enough to drop some of his powerful character defenses and to make contact with the soulful part of himself that had been locked up underneath. He was a bodybuilder, a football player. He was about 230 pounds. He was involved as a high school guidance counselor. He often got work as a bouncer. He was a formidable guy to be contended with. But he started to let himself down into the life that he didn't want to look at. And here's the first dream that came up at this time. We're in a huge hotel. I am the bodyguard for this child who seems sacred or special in some way, almost like a Christ child. He's in an adjoining room. Somehow the child doesn't know who he is. I can feel the presence of an evil person, someone who has come for the boy and is very close. I become vigilant, alert. Then there's an explosion set off by the evil one. I run into the child's room. He's 5 to 7 years old. The explosion occurred next door to him. The child is in shock. I recognize him and know who he is. The images of his life flash by me. The only one I recall now is the image of a little blonde boy in school innocently curling his cowlick. I sit down next to this boy, knowing the explosion was only meant to tease. If they really wanted to kill this child, they would have. Isn't that an interesting statement? It's like the defense is on the side of the growing ego somewhere. I also know that in the wreckage next door, they'll find the destroyed, mutilated body of a girl who knew this child, and the explosion had killed her. They had tortured her, trying to get to this boy. But the signs of this, they knew this, would be obliterated in the explosion. She had martyred herself to save this boy. I now start to shake this boy. Who are you? Who are you? Do you know who you are? His eyes remain fixed, then roll back into the back of his head. My anger is mounting. I knock him to the ground. I can see a little smile on his face. Perhaps I've made contact with him, but he won't look at me. I feel so frustrated. I leave the room crying out of helplessness. Then, in the final part, I'm trying to tell this dream to a man upstairs. A woman present has instructed me to tell him the whole story. I'm relieved at the prospect of this telling, but I'm blocked, as if I've had electroshock or something, like amnesia. I can't remember his life story. I think perhaps I should go back for his history, but I'll never escape the evil one if I do. I wake myself up. Now, isn't that remarkable? He was very shaken by this dream, but also excited to decipher its meaning. He had several associations To the boy twirling the cowlick, he recalled a picture of himself at age 3, standing on a chair at the kitchen sink with his mother, playing with a lock of his hair. And he had felt compassion for that little boy that was him, one of the few moments in our work together where he actually felt compassion for that little boy, at least early on. To the autistic child, he associated his own hardened inner child, the part of him in a trance that had stopped attaching to anyone. But this child, the dream now made clear, was somehow divine. It held his own transcendent spirit. And Mike is now in the role of the child's guardian, trying to make contact with him. The explosion set off by the evil one, Mike thought, was like the anger that often exploded in him to cover up and defend against the pain of his early life. So he was already starting to get the message. And to the man upstairs, he associated me, his animal. My office was upstairs, and to the woman who was encouraging him to tell the whole story to his analyst, he didn't have any particular associations to her, except that she then started to appear in much of the dream material. Now my second example is a story I've written about elsewhere, but I want to tell you again because it's such a vivid example of the uncanny intelligence of the psyche, and because it demonstrates how the light can come through the broken places. And maybe some of you will recognize this story from my first book. A mother sends a young daughter to her father's study one morning to deliver an important note written on a piece of paper. The little girl goes off with the note and returns in tears, saying, "I'm sorry, Mommy, the angel won't let me go in." Whereupon the mother sends the daughter back a second time with the same result, only this time more tears and distress. At this point, the mother becomes irritated at her little girl's imaginative excess, takes her by the hand, and marches her down to the father's study. She stops dead in her tracks in the threshold of the room, looking through the doorway. She sees her husband, the little girl's father, dead in his chair. His drink having fallen out of his hand, now dead from a massive heart attack. So here we see Henrietta Wyeth in her painting called Death in the Child, which illustrates this poignant moment. I found this up at the in Maine at the Rockport Museum. I hadn't ever seen it before. In the painting, you can see the angel protecting the child from a reality that the child cannot manage. Now, there are three ways to interpret this event. If we took our usual materialistic reductionist view, then the child made up the angel in order to tolerate the intolerable. Thus, the angel would be a fantasy, a hallucination, a defense. Freud thought, as we know, all religion was a derivative of such defenses. On the other hand, if we took the other extreme, a supernatural position, we would say that the guardian angel on high saw the little girl's plight and intervened in her earthly existence at this moment of impossible suffering, and we might even describe such an event as a genuine miracle or a moment of salvation. So what would a psycho-spiritual approach between the worlds say? It might go something as follows. The guardian angel could be viewed dispensably, yes, but then comes the question, what is it defending? And where does its uncanny wisdom and compassion come from? Could the angel represent a universal self-protective agency in the collective psyche that sometimes intervenes in the ego's affairs when it is confronted by the too much of trauma, intervenes in order to keep the innocent part of this person out of too much suffering in reality, as if to preserve that innocent part for the future, or for some time when it might start to be able to accrue experience in a more incremental way. Here's the way Emily Dickinson puts it. There is a pain so utter that it swallows substance up, then covers the abyss with trance. So memory can step around, across, upon it, as one within a swoon goes safely, where an open eye would drop him, bone by bone. The traumatic trance to which this poet alludes is something I previously called the self-care system, and as I just said, the purpose of this intelligent system seems to be to keep an innocent core of us out of further suffering in reality. It covers the abyss with trance, trying to keep this innocent remnant of the whole self from being further impacted. Now that is of course a problem, because once that defense is in place, then transitional space has collapsed, experience no longer accrues, the child disappears more and more into the inner world, and this is the problem of this little girl with her angel. While we may look at the goal of this defense in positive terms, if something doesn't intervene to help this little girl metabolize her trauma, then the angel will turn persecutory. And this is, seems to be the way that the inner world moves from one protective form to a persecutory form. But the defense's goal, and here's what I'm trying to interest us in tonight, the deepest goal would be to restore, for the time being, a mythopoetic matrix between reality and fantasy, because this is where the little girl's soul is. She now has a salvation story, and the defense restores a mythopoetic matrix within which her soul can stay alive, because this is where the soul lives. It lives in this intermediate space between the imaginal and the real, between the material and the spiritual. Now, to say that the human soul lives in this mythopoetic matrix between reality and fantasy is one way to think about, as I've said before, the importance that Winnicott gives to transitional space. He even says if transitional space is kept open, something called indwelling occurs. Indwelling. Indwelling of what? And Winnicott isn't quite clear. He says, well, it's the psyche in the soma. That's about as close as he'll come. At one point he says, it's the self that isn't really fully the self, but if it's split off from the self, then we have depersonalization. So, along with indwelling comes personalization. These are all Winnicott's terms, but they're very interesting because they're not far from the word incarnation. And Winnicott's idea is the mother introduces and reintroduces the baby's mind and body to each other. And slowly, with that process, something, some mysterious vital core of us takes up residence in the body. That's our incarnational story, and it's a beautiful one. So, okay, as I say, we don't know the end of that story, and it could be a bad one, but for now we know that the angel had a huge impact on this little girl and kept her in being. Now, my last story, which I call Sophie and Her Lost Stories. I have to ask Dan to turn off. I got a letter from someone. You can turn the tape back on. Someone I'd never met who had read my first book and had been helped by it, and she said I was helped by it spiritually. And I wondered what she meant. She'd been struggling with depression, and she said in a letter to me that followed this call, quote, when I read your book, the stranger within me came to the window and cried. I was very touched by this statement, although I didn't know why. The woman seemed to be saying that some passages in the book had moved her and mirrored her soul, a fugitive part of herself that had become a stranger to her, but that could now return from its place of exile in the threshold between inner and outer worlds, the window. This, in turn, enabled her to feel her deep and heretofore unreachable sadness. And this was the first step towards healing her depression, towards making her whole again. And this is the way I think it is with the human soul. it seems to need a resonant image from the human or the non-human environment if it is to come forward, something it recognizes. We can imagine that the infant responds to this resonant image repeatedly in the deep embodied holding by its mother and in the equally soulful eye contact and gaze that is a part of their mutual play and loving connection. These moments, which we now realize are so critical to later secure attachment and even to the healthy formation of the brain, are the first quickening of the soul, the earliest beginnings of its indwelling, as Winnicott would say. Later, other resonant images will quicken the soul through intimate contact with others in the interpersonal world of the child. Still later, and in other settings, this resonance will come from sources beyond the interpersonal, the beauties of nature, the awesome realities of the cosmos, the soulful eyes of an animal, inspiring music, elevating ideas, a good psychotherapy session, even psychological descriptions in a book. Therapy for the soul comes in many forms and from many places, not just in the mother-infant dyad or in its later recreation in the consulting room. But for those of us who work in the consulting room day in and day out, having a theory that honors the reality of the soul and the depth of the spirit becomes important. This theory can never be systematic or scientific because the soul and spirit are mercurial realities, quixotic, ineffable, and can never be pinned down. As the seat of our subjectivity, they can never be an object of investigation in scientific discourse. As light itself, it lives between the worlds, now wave, now particle. If we were wise, we would probably keep silent about the souls and learn to listen. But this is impossible. At least it is for me. We are compelled to talk about it, and so I've been jabbering on here about the soul for the whole evening. I've told you some stories about encounters with the soul or the spirit. These stories, like the others in my book, are anecdotal and not amenable to statistical analysis. Yet they are factual. They are empirical realities, and so I believe they have a claim on scientific truth. They actually happen. And sometimes, not always, they are the most important things that happen in a person's life or in the course of a psychoanalytic treatment. They are also, to me, the most interesting stories on the planet. At least, they are, as far as I'm concerned, and how could we not tell them? Perhaps their telling on occasions like this evening in Amherst or in the pages of my book will allow the stranger within some of us to come to the window in recognition of that evanescent, shimmering reality presenting itself at every interface between the worlds. We call this reality the human soul. It participates in both eternity and time, and so do we. Thank you. Yeah, questions, comments, disagreements? Yes, in the back. Why don't we take the microphone to you?
Can you repeat something that you said in the very beginning? And that was trauma is encountering the world before you have
a chance to create it.
Thank you.
In other words, he's working off of Winnicott's, the baby finds the breast and creates the breast at the same time. And you never ask the baby which it is because it comes from inside and outside. And it's both and it's a paradox. And trauma is about encountering the world before you've had a chance to create it. Does that make sense? In other words, too much reality too soon. You don't get a chance to participate in the creation of your reality. If you get a chance to participate in the creation of your reality, you're a lucky kid. And none of us have that perfectly. I mean, there's no perfect scenario of parenting. Trauma is universal. But so is repair. I mean, this was a pretty bad event that happened between Sophie and her mother. And yet, it was repaired. So, Other questions, comments? Yes.
I'm struck by it.
Just a moment.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
Me?
Yeah.
What you just said about the self-care mother's part. It seems to me that perhaps in a lot of words, less of the numbing factor, but it's really doing. But the kind of trauma that often happens in within the family is not an explosion like that. It's a slow,
yes,
steady, much harder in a way to get at the kind of experience.
That's right. It's full of mystification.
Yes.
The comment was that a lot of the trauma, the small t trauma that occurs in terms of emotional derailment, insecure attachment, emotional mystification, are small drifts. They're not just big explosions. They're small events, and they're, Masood Khan wrote a whole chapter in what he called cumulative trauma. They accumulate. And the interesting thing is that they add up to the same devastation. It's different, but it's a devastation, nonetheless. Yeah. Thank you. Yes?
Yeah, hi.
You want a microphone?
I just speak really loud.
Okay.
It just makes me think that, you know, what does this say about the treatment for kids? You know, we have all these new treatments, you know, and these muscles, and I remember doing some work with our therapist, and really describing that as like soul touching, you know? And so I just think of these kids or people that, you know, are pathologized into such discrete categories, and then you're talking about what makes them like really soul touching. And bringing,
yeah,
you know, all this linguistic and all the experiences together, and these different kinds of realities, it's huge.
Well, it is huge. A lot of our kids these days are being treated, you know, with drugs and medication, heavy medication, and the idea is to get them back on the track as fast as possible to, you know, onward and upward in the garden, so to speak. And this is a very different story, isn't it? It's very interesting that, I don't know, some of you read Alan Shore's work in the field. Alan Shore is a neuro psychologist, and he's collected together a great deal of information about how the early childhood brain is formed. And he's shown, for example, that the right hemisphere develops earlier than the left and is the hemisphere that's dominant in very early life when a lot of trauma occurs. And so we can't really reach this level of development through insight and the kinds of higher order left hemispheric processes of insight and so forth that psychoanalysis used to specialize in. But what we can use is metaphor, story, dreams, and the relational field with the client, which is much more a right brain to right brain in Alan Shore's language. So we're getting some proof now that this is not just a romantic story. If we want to really reach people on the level of their deep and early wounding, we have to enter that process of sensitivity to all these softer techniques, right? That use the mythopoetic, that reopen transitional space, that reopen attachment, reopen transitional space, use the mythopoetic, metaphor, story, dream, and reconnect with people's souls. But that's what brings people back. Yes?
Can I just say a question, actually? Can I ask you a couple of things, if you can respond? I was going to ask you how your thoughts interface with the neurobiologist's work that is currently helping children with developmental problems. But I wanted to take issue with something you said.
Please.
This is Northampton, not Amherst. I understand.
I am. And that is correct procedure, but...
you're coming from that direction, of course.
Right. Or in any direction. This is the center. I want to know, you're talking about a child, but does what you're talking about apply to trauma that happens as an adult?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let me say a word about that, because we're all in a post-traumatic world here in the Northeast, or you guys have been really feeling this from the Boston Marathon bombing. One thing we've discovered in our work now is that trauma like 9/11, it's interesting, I was here in November of 2001, 2 months after that, and spoke here in Northampton. At Smith College on that day, and I remember us processing together the real trauma of 9/11. And now we're a few weeks after the Boston Marathon bombing. One thing we've discovered is that if you have a history of early unremembered trauma, you're going to have a much more powerful aftershock reaction to an adult trauma like what we've just been through than if you don't have that history. If you have a pretty secure attachment history and one relatively free of trauma, and this isn't the case everywhere, but you will go through the usual reactions of anxiety, sleeplessness, and you know, maybe you'll have some profound insecurities that will come back, maybe you'll have increased vigilance, sleep problems, and so on. But after a period of 3 or 4 or 5 months, the trauma will dissipate. And you'll be back to a more or less normal psychology. If you have early trauma that you don't know about, unremembered trauma, it will be triggered by this event. And not always, but oftentimes people will report a huge amplification of the existing adult experience from the early experience. And so that may lead to, you know, recurrent flashbacks, recurrent nightmares, a need for medication, addictions. You really need to go to work on this and to try to find out what's been triggered in the early life. And we all have some early trauma, so I'm speaking now on a spectrum. I'm using these two extremes as an illustration. So it's a terrible thing to have unremembered trauma wake up, because it doesn't seem to belong to the event that it's been at. And you can't figure out, and your doctors can't figure out why you're so upset about this. This goes back to something that Winnicott said in one of his papers, where he said that a lot of people walk around with terrible fears of things happening in the future. For example, someone may carry an obsessive fear of a psychotic breakdown, and may carry it around despite the fact that they're reassured. Winnicott says, usually when that happens, it's what's happening is that there's been a breakdown. The breakdown has already happened. And their only access to the breakdown that's already happened is the fear of the future. Profound insight. I have a patient who right now has called me up. He's got a panic about... he's had a small spike in his PSA, his prostate readings. And he's collapsing. His wife can't understand what's happening to him. He's afraid of death. He's terrified of a biopsy. He's always had a sensitivity and huge overreaction to medical procedures in general. But we started to work together to try to figure out, and there were two hospitalizations before the age of 2 for major surgeries on hernias on both sides of his body. And so he's now going back into his history to find out how he responded to those events, because he's carried this terror of, you know, his brother died a couple of years ago, and he had the same panic and fear then that was amplified all beyond any kind of reasonable, genuine fears that he had. And yet, there was something working itself out. It was like a fear of something that had already happened that he could not remember. And his memory was the panic. It was the self state that he was in when he was an infant, now repeated, but long since, you know, forgotten, maybe dissociated, possibly, but no help with it, you know. How many times have I heard from patients that they were told, you know, they had a tonsillectomy, and they were told it would be fine, and they'd have ice cream the next day, and there would be no problem, and mommy and daddy would stay with them the whole time, and they end up at the hospital, and mommy and daddy can't stay with them, and they're beside themselves with fear, and then the next day they're in abysmal pain, and they feel terribly betrayed, and they can't eat for a week, and there's no ice cream after all, etc. I mean, and these aren't ill-intentioned parents, they're parents that are trying to be good men and women and compliant with the doctors know best, and the hospitals have their regulations and procedures and so on. So yeah, I mean, trauma is about experience that we cannot bear to experience consciously yet.
But need to,
absolutely need to. We need to, and we need, as mental health practitioners, we need to know that the only way to get through this and out the other side is to experience the past traumatic event with a compassionate, safe, in a safe place with compassion and goodness. And we're getting better at that now. We're getting better at attending to what's going on inside people. You know, we just didn't know this stuff existed. When I started out in my clinical psych work, there was no discussion of trauma. I mean, there was discussion of shell shock. You know, but we didn't know anything about how exquisitely sensitive the growing infant and young child are to ruptures in the continuity of their attachments and their security and their safety. So, yes, microphone over there.
Thanks. See if I can remember. I forget when I have trauma. What did I say? I guess I was thinking about the devastator that was in hell.
Right.
And how he was filled with pride.
Right.
And that I had the sense that to be in that deep level of hell, that he actually wasn't traumatized.
He wasn't traumatized?
No, not. He still had the pride. And that the idea that when we incarnate and forget where we came from, that we're, becoming small, and we're also seeing that everyone around us thinks that they're small. And the way I'm thinking of it is that, like, the soldiers fighting over the baby, that there's this big bravado that adults think we're so big. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we know how little we are in this whole world.
Right.
And so we go, okay, we're small, and then that's why we can't bear to handle the big event that's coming at us, because it's bigger than us. And it's, you know, it's like Godzilla with Bambi or something. So
You saw that.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering if there's two different events happening. One is that impact from the outside world, like, oh my God, the outside world is way big.
Right.
And the other one is that angel that comes in to cocoon and protect ourselves is another, from the inner world.
Right.
The other luminous entrance that comes in simultaneously. We want to become small in order to still be, to see how great the world is from that perspective.
Right.
And that I guess, you know, the idea that we should try to find a way to not be traumatized, it seems like this is, that, you know, the cocoon that creates the internal self, that saves the internal world,
right,
that will then come back and redeem the person and redeem the world. That this, I guess, I just want to say that this process seems to be, the whole thing is meant to happen in a way.
Absolutely.
And we're not meant to try to, like, untraumatize the world.
No, no, there's no way around this process. That's absolutely right. I'm interested that you're talking about becoming small. The Christian word for what Christ did when he came down into this world, you know, it's like Superboy out of Krypton, out of his divine identification, was he emptied himself, kenosis. He emptied himself of his divine plenitude in order to become human. And in some ways, that's the process of evolution development for all of us. We start off with the trauma story of a lot of young kids is a mythological story before it's a personal one. Richard Charlesdale made that same point in a wonderful article. Where was it, in spring?
Jung Journal Psyche and the one from San Francisco.
Okay, San Francisco Library Journal, I believe it was, yeah. But in other words, these experiences in the mythopoetic realm are archetypal, and slowly Kohat talked about idealizing energy, self-esteem generation through idealizing energy, and slowly phase-appropriate disillusionment. We have to come down into embodied reality slowly, incrementally, and that's a loss, but it's also a huge gain, because we gain communion and connection and intimacy through love with our fellow men and women, and we get to give up all that grandiosity. I mean, we can return to it at any time, of course. Fly into a rage, fall in love. It's always around.
That's how you can refer to your heart's home.
Right. You can be introduced by a previous mentor and feel all slightly elevated from your chair and get up and speak.
There, what would you like to say?
Hi.
Sorry. That's okay. Go ahead.
You had a great quote earlier. I think it was one of Jung's quotes, and you said it became a central conviction. And one of the things you said was that the mother is more than a personal mother,
right,
the imago. And I think you were alluding to, or what he was alluding to, is the divine feminine or the eternal feminine as the ground,
right,
the ground of all of this. And that's something I've been thinking about, is how the feminine is really the site of the wound. It's the original site of where between the dyad of the mother and the child, and how the psyche works. It has to return, in a sense, to the site of the original wound in order to kind of complete the cycle of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I was mentioning earlier how we can't metabolize the pain, but we have to consciously go back to it. We have to return to it to metabolize it and kind of heal that trauma. So I was wondering if you could kind of speak a little bit more about the eternal feminine, because I think there's kind of a movement towards this now with some of the contemporary non-dual teachings about the emphasis on surrender and the movement of separation, our first experience of separation, and moving into a more direct experience of unity, which is what we experience, as infants. The mother, we experience ourselves as one with the mother,
mm-hmm,
and then we experience our own separation. And then the goal being, as we become more embodied, we kind of make a return, in a sense, to a sense of oneness, not with a personal mother, but more with the ground of eternal feminine.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if you wanted to add a little bit to that.
I don't think there's an awful lot that I have to add. The thing that I wanted to just say is that I think what Jung was saying here is that the interpersonal world for us is the most powerful world, place, but it's not only personal. Okay, I mean, something shines through our contact with each other. And in this case, he's saying, something shines through the mother, that's the eternal feminine, and something shines through the child. So you can't get the full story with a purely relational, interpersonal psychology. And that's Jung's major contribution to me. He's saying we are all carriers of the spirit for each other. And if you find a soulmate, it's not just a pretty girl or a pretty guy. Something has happened that has quickened a deep part of you from between worlds. And what I'm trying to say tonight is that it's really important to keep the two worlds in tension and to realize that something very special happens when those two worlds are allowed to exist together. In our relationships, in our relationship with each other, in our relationship with nature. And they're always trying to close. The defense is always trying to close them. When you see the images of Hades tomorrow, it's close, 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 close. It's the first gated community. And there's gate after gate after gate after gate. And behind each one sits the fallen angel. So, versus the kinds of energies that open us and heal us are open, open, open. So that's the work we do, trying to open those flows. There.
Thank you, Don, for this remarkable presentation. I have two observations or responses. One has to do with the experience in the military in combat, where there is now so much PTSD, and your observation, which I think makes some sense, is that the experience of immediate trauma has a relationship to early trauma, and whether that early trauma is totally unconscious and unremembered, or whether it is remembered.
Right.
Many years after the war, I was in the infantry in combat. I had the opportunity in a therapeutic process to get in touch with some very powerful PTSD, and it clearly for me was related to an experience of early trauma that I did remember and was aware of. And what I wonder is whether any research of any kind has been done in our present cultural situation where soldiers who are suffering PTSD and are getting one or another form of therapy, whether there's been any research that explores those soldiers which suffered early trauma as over against those who had relatively little trauma, and how that may have affected them in their war experience.
You know, I don't know the research, but do any of you here know whether those studies have been done? I'm sure they haven't. I can't imagine they haven't. But it's possible they haven't. It's a really good question there.
Yeah. The other comment is I listened to you describe all of the various ways that the light cracks through or the light shines through the radiance between the mother and the child and how this is related to an experience of soul. But one thing you really didn't directly address is the experience of religious believers, whatever their tradition may be, in their worship, in their rituals, in their experience of the newness, the transpersonal, and to what degree we might then say that is an opening of the light that helps individuals within this community
absolutely
to experience both individual soul and soul connection, because I think that's the very core of authentic worship and religious life.
Absolutely. The core of authentic worship and religious life is an effort to open, right? To open the field, to open the space between this world and the next, between life limited, space and time bound, and the infinite, the ineffable. Whether it's ritual, whether it's the old piety cults of the American Indians, whether it's dance, all of these techniques are designed to really open those thin places between the worlds, and so that the numinous energy comes in. They actualize a mythopoetic in a community. They tell stories, we tell stories, we go through, you know, how many character friends of mine have said what we lost when we lost the mass, the mythopoetic dimension of the mystery in the mass is now just a word thing. You know, it's just a homily. It's no longer the language that we don't know, the meditative process of opening to that chanting or that ritual. So yeah, I mean, that's a terribly important thing to intentionally open that space. Yes. Do we have 5 more minutes?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then
we're gonna have a little party.
Okay.
I just wanted to come back to the incarnation, of course, because if this isn't embodied, then there is no healing. And how important that is, and what how difficult that is of bringing somebody, of encouraging somebody to come down into the emotional, sensational body, and all the demons that are in the body that attack. That process goes on,
as
you say more about that.
Well, you know, as you said that, if it's not embodied, there is no healing. There isn't the kind of healing that we want, that we are ambitious for, that we know is necessary if this early trauma that's captured in the body is going to really be healed. But there are a lot of people who have a kind of practice that doesn't involve the body very much, that are maybe halfway healed. I don't know exactly what to say. Master Khan talked about self-cure, and he talked about a lot of people who have a kind of, for them, a very meaningful wholeness providing understanding. It's mostly in the spirit world. It's not very embodied yet. The way I like to think about it sometimes is that some people come to a Jungian analyst because they've found their way to one of the New Age disciplines or another, and they've found very important, helpful, contained environment for their process. It doesn't always sustain them through a whole individuation process, but sometimes I see those people as having erected a scaffold around the outside of a building. And the scaffold needs to be in place, really terribly important, as they come down and work on the body and work on the integration of their feeling life and their affects, and tolerate more affect and start to feel more feelings. And as that happens, sometimes they become less identified with the celestial, spiritual structures that have sustained them for some time, and they become more integrated, I would say. So yeah, I mean, I think that's.
And one thing that I've found too is that sometimes you talk about the sensitive person,
right?
that actually those sensitive people are in both worlds, and they need to have to keep that connection between both worlds being embodied and
yes,
spiritual,
absolutely.
And if they come through the trauma, they actually rediscover their connection to the spiritual.
That's an interesting point.
Vibrational
yes.
experience in the body.
Right. Absolutely. Anita.
I remember a case of that illustrates that very well. A woman who came to me, very intelligent, was in a kind of job where she could use her head very creatively. And every time she came in, I almost had to hold onto the arms of my chair because I felt I was being lifted up and I was going to be taking off into some kind of stratosphere with her.
Mm-hmm.
And then she brought in a dream in which she was out in space, kind of on a little planet all by herself. There was an umbilical cord connecting her to Earth, but she was far enough out. And it was quite difficult for her and others to leave some kind of safety of that spiritual realm.
Wow.
To come back into being embodied.
Right, exactly.
So we very often would sit on the floor,
uh-huh.
and during the session we would tug at that umbilical cord, bring it a little closer. And each time we would stop when it got too much for her to handle.
Right.
And gradually she became, allowed herself down into her belly more and into the affects that she was obviously defending against.
Right.
And some very, very worrisome, disturbing trauma early on.
Yes.
And what the amazing thing she discovered as we did that, very, you know, tug by tug by tug,
uh-huh.
and in the small doses, sometimes you have to do it in kind of small doses,
sure.
she came to realize that being in the embodied was not nearly as painful as she had projected onto it.
Okay.
From her planet out.
Right,
space.
Right.
And that case example just came to me.
It's a remarkable case example. I wish I had had it when I wrote my chapter on the little prince.
One more question?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the scaffolding
yes.
we're talking about. I was a therapist previously, and now I do acupuncture.
Mm.
One of the things that I've noticed working with patients with kind of the emotional, behavioral, and cognitive patterns that keep you from going into the body, so to speak, acupuncture or energy work actually allows you to get much more in touch with the cellular memories.
That's right.
And I think integrating more of a psychoanalytic or a therapeutic approach as well as energy work really allows for a deeper healing process. I have found it.
And well, I've found it too, and I'm very glad for your contribution here because I couldn't agree more. And it reminds me that Jung. This is in the Nietzsche seminars, if you want to read a lot on the body. He talks a lot about the subtle body in the Nietzsche seminars. He also says that we have two dimensions of the unconscious. One he calls the somatic unconscious, and the other he calls the celestial unconscious. So on the celestial side, we have all these archetypal images, but no affects, no embodied. On the somatic side, we have things encoded in the body, but no access to them. And so he's really saying that most likely when we split and the unbearable experience is going to get registered, it's going to get registered in both places. So we'll have archetypal images without affects, and then we'll have these deep proto-affects in the body without images. And so we can work on both sides to try to gain access, you know, to the middle ground. And in The Little Prince, I was thinking of Anita's comment, you know, the one thing that convinces the little prince that he might come down into this world is his dialogue with the fox. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
And he and Fox have to tame each other. And this is a beautiful image of the transference, of the fact that that process of gaining confidence that it's worth it to come down. There was a lot of feeling in between you and this client on the floor there. I mean, a great deal of sense of gratitude and safety and love and connection that was enabling that process. I mean, you were taming each other in the little princess language.
Okay,
thank you all very much.